morning, everyone. Welcome to the Wednesday, March 15th meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have a really full agenda today, so even though we do not have a really full dais just yet, we want to get started so that we can hear from some distinguished guests who've made the trip to come be with us. I'm going to start by opening an information session about one of the most exciting things that we have going on in economic development in the state of Oregon, and that's the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. And I'll invite forward Senator Betsy Johnson, Adrian Allen of the University of Sheffield Advanced Manufacturing Research Center, and invite you to orient us to the project and any additional people with your group who are coming forward. Welcome, Senator Johnson. Good to see you.
Thank you very kindly, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Everything that's good has an engineer at the heart.
Do you want to start that now? Okay, this will be the introduction.
Okay, that sounds great.
Companies as regions, as a nation, and not bringing people into engineering, we're missing something key. This MRC model, this academic. Everything that's good has an engineer at the heart of it. So if we as companies, as regions, as a nation, and not bringing people into engineering, we're missing something key.
It was rolling.
Everything that's good has an engineer at the heart of it. So if we as companies, as regions, as a nation, and not bringing people into engineering, we're missing something key. This Boeing AMRC model, this academic, industrial, governmental collaboration that set us apart from, I'd say, other academic institutions, is the fact that our research has an industry partnership. We couldn't welcome the center without that Boeing name badge on it. Big companies, they come to us to help them develop this process for manufacturing parts. The Boeing model, it's almost like instead of giving you fish, it's teach you how to fish. We have got major global companies coming in here, partnering with us on major projects. There are companies out there now who have made decisions going forward based on our data, based on our practices, that have fundamentally changed the way they go about their business. The aerospace industry is key in the United Kingdom. There are millions of jobs that depend on the success we have. The Boeing company is responsible for 55,000 jobs. And since 2004, when we opened the first Boeing Advanced Manufacturing Research Center, it's grown to having over 1,800 good, sustainable jobs on there, high-tech jobs, and it's expanding every single day. And just this week, we took on 164 apprentices, and our plans are next year, 250, and for every year following. We've done the full loop, design, manufacture, test, and the human resource side of it. We really have changed an industrial landscape. The place we're in today is an ex-coal mine that had been closed in the 1970s. High unemployment, no employment whatsoever. So growing up and witnessing that, we wanted to actually do something about that, redress the balance. You can imagine being born and bred here, to see something good at long last come out of a site that was so much sorrow is particularly fulfilling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. I have with me today Adrian Allen, the Commercial Director of the Advanced Manufacturing Research Center in Sheffield, England, and Bill Gary with the Boeing Company, to introduce to you all, and apologies to Representative Gomberg, who's heard this now three times.
And enjoyed it every time, Madam Chair.
Right answer. One of the most exciting things to happen to Oregon, I believe a transformational opportunity for Oregon. And I'm going to ask Adrian to describe in a little more detail than the video what he did to transform the industrial and economic landscape of Sheffield, England, where he hails from, and then to present a little bit of why this is so important for Oregon, our ability to retain and grow jobs here, as well as be a catalytic ignition device to bring other inward investment into the United States and certainly into Oregon. So, Adrian Allen.
Thank you.
So, members, for reference, my name's Allen, Adrian Allen, and I'm here really to support Senator Johnson in her efforts to do something quite radical, which I believe, if done correctly, will truly transform the industrial landscape of the state of Oregon. Certainly, our experience in Sheffield, England, as you may have picked up there, is with the help of the Boeing Company and the brand, that name that captured the imagination and inspired youngsters to come on board and join in our venture. I believe we can take something which at the moment has very little good about it, a disused piece of land, I'm not speaking out of turn here, very similar to what we were confronted with in Sheffield. What we achieved was from 2004 when we built our first little center along the lines of what we're proposing here. There's eight of us. Today I employ 1,100 highly paid staff. I have an excess of 500 masters and PhD graduates in there, all paid for by industry undertaking meaningful research. We always set out in our mission that this research center on a 200-acre dilapidated coal mine, ex-coal mine site, which within a one-mile radius of that had 91% unemployment because of the demise of the coal industry in the UK 30 years ago, we'd now have brought in billions of inward investment onto that park. Real high-value manufacturers, real high-value jobs, 2,500 in total on a 200-acre site. Just 3 weeks ago, it's now four, I've been here for a week, and I apologize if I'm slurring a little bit, but you've got to believe this lobbying stuff and running around here is enough to kill horses. How it must be for you guys having to listen to people coming through, and you've got from the sublime to, you know, all ends. I don't know how you do it. In my case, it's on drugs, very hard drugs at the moment, keeping me awake. So I do apologize for that. But seriously, with the work I've done to support so far Senator Johnson, she came over to our place because she, like many senior ministers of state, I've hosted 30 ministers from around the different countries around the world coming to see how this academic, industrial, governmental model has created such meaningful wealth and jobs. And she came along a couple of years ago on her own dollar for the record to find out what was going on. And I think she was gobsmacked, that's an English word, I think she was amazed at the quality and quantity of jobs we'd created in there. So I phoned her up the other week and I said, this one's a new one. We signed a deal just over four weeks ago, say, with the McLaren car company. For those that don't know, McLaren are Formula One, they do make a production car. Sheffield is not a car-making city. But they have invested in there, and within 2 years there's going to be 250 more jobs there with youngsters making the lightest, most expensive, fastest cars in the world. The story just goes on and on, and I believe, and I've pitched this a number of times, if we get the right people doing the right things for the right reason with the right support, we really can attract, entice, and bring the best brains. Today we're proud to have OIT. The support they've given this venture is without question unsurpassed. To have a university come in here and actually say they're putting money in rather than taking money out, I think is quite unique. They put a few million in to match the funding on the building there. And as we start, quite honestly, we have got 15 million, I reckon, of industrial backing. This is before you look to match commitments of the highest end equipment for manufacturing future bits and pieces for a key sector of the economy, which is advanced transport systems. Without laboring this and going on, transport is set to double in market in the next 10 years. And you've got indigenous business here in key areas of transport. You have truck builders here, ship builders, railroad builders, and of course, you've got the world's biggest aircraft builder. this company has got the biggest order book of any company in the whole world. And its shareholders, many of which are here today, you have pensions and shares invested in major US companies. They have a decision of where to place their manufacturing going forward. They have to double output in the next 10 years. And when you're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of turnover, you know, I think there's a distinct opportunity to grow something on the back of them and other indigenous companies here. So,
thank you very much. Bill?
Well, thank you, Betsy, Chair Leonard, and committee. My name is William Gary. I'm with the Boeing Company and have been working for the last about 10 or 12 months on this particular project. And I have the very great misfortune today of speaking after Senator Johnson and my dear friend Adrian Allen, but I'll give it a shot, and hopefully we'll be able to share a little bit of my message and the Boeing Company's message with you. As you well know, and as Adrian has implied, manufacturing is in a very challenging position, not only in this state, but nationally. Competition is rife, and we are all faced with some very serious decisions to be made. The Boeing Company, suffering from a huge backlog, many people can't understand how that would be suffering, but suffering from a huge backlog and increased competition from global competitors in the aerospace business and a collapsing supply chain where more and more suppliers are being gobbled up by large companies. We are entering into an era where we are going to establish a new strategy called vertical integration, where the Boeing Company will be pulling work from its supply chain, which, by the way, is in low labor rate markets, back into our home fabrication facilities. One of those fabrication facilities, and I don't know if you're aware, is in Gresham, the home of 1,600 hard-working professional and trade union folks who have worked hard to make sure that the Gresham plant is competitive in the Boeing fabrication family. That work will give us an opportunity to create continued growth and job creation in the region. But in order to do that, we have to have the right technology and the right techniques and the right tools to be able to do the work in the same footprint that we have today in Gresham. The idea of using new and innovative techniques, new multifunctional machines, new cutting tools, and new processes is what the OMIC R&D effort is about, bringing that AMRC capability, partnering with the AMRC and University of Sheffield to bring those technologies forward. I did have some prepared remarks. I think the message has been given, and it is our hope that as we work together here in the state of Oregon with our university partners, OSU, PSU, and Oregon Tech, and the six launch partners that have stepped up and made serious commitments to this project already, we can look to the state and each one of you to support our project as we move forward. Thank you.
I would just conclude by saying that with Adrian's global reach, we have already attracted about $15 million worth of equipment that has been donated. I was coming into the parking garage the other day, and Adrian called me from the UK to say that an Austrian company had just given our enterprise a machine worth 2.5 million euros. We're going to be coming to the legislature to ask for some additional bonding and operating capacity. We've got to get these machines from Japan in one case, Austria in another case, get them here and get them installed and get operators trained on the use of these machines. The companies that are providing these machines are not doing it because they love Oregon. They're doing it with the catnip possibility that they could get back into Boeing's supply chain. Once a piece is made for an aircraft, because the FAA certification is so rigorous, that piece will be on that airplane for the next 25 years. And so from Klamath Falls to Albany to Gresham to Scappoose to Portland to Corvallis, this is an Oregon enterprise. It happens to be located in Scappoose because we are within the gravitational pull of the Portland metro area, a major international airport, and the Gresham facility, where, as Bill said, 1,600 Oregonians now work. We're also right across the hill from the Intel, largest R&D in the world. In England, they talk about the Boeing effect, where at Adrian's Park, people wanting to cluster together to be part of Boeing's supply chain or to service the other industries that are there. There are multiple disciplines at the AMRC. We've had an overture from a multi-billion dollar U.S. company that wants to again to come to our campus with the idea of being able to service the Intel plant and eventually build a building if that proves efficacious for them. Again, with Adrian's help, the largest Japanese cutting tool company was going to go to Seattle, is now seriously looking at landing in Oregon. And so it's already happening, even in this nascent stage. And I just want to thank, again, in front of this committee and in front of him, Dr. Naganathan's Oregon Tech, for having the nimble entrepreneurial mindset that said, yes, we're going to step forward and be a lead partner in the academic part of this enterprise. PCC is going to come alongside us, build a campus in South Columbia County that will be the replication of the training academy that Adrian has. So we have, as Bill said, PSU, OSU, Oregon Tech, PCC, and hands across the ocean, a relationship with the University of Sheffield, where they will be doing research with Boeing to support the Gresham facility. So the why Scappoose question comes up all the time. I would suggest to you all that this is an Oregon initiative, that we will all benefit from the presence of this research center, the academic, the growing of new engineers to go into a worker-starved industry and regain the manufacturing a preeminence that Oregon, well, you know, Madam Chair, your old employer, part of the manufacturing eco-culture in this state. We want to make the state proud of our manufacturing. We want to sell globally, and this is the start to being able to revitalize manufacturing. As Adrian says, if it floats, flies, or freights, we want to do the R&D, and we want to build it greener, cleaner, faster, and better for the benefit of Oregon's economy. Thank you very much for hearing us.
Excellent. Any questions for this panel? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but a comment. I have indeed heard this presentation three times, and I remain in awe. Can I just say, we talk all the time about creating not just more jobs, but good jobs in Oregon, and this is a game-changing example of exactly how we do that on a large scale. I wanted to thank Bill and Adrian, and particular Senator Johnson for her leadership. My only disappointment is that they didn't find Lincoln County first.
That's great. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And I want to echo Representative Gomberg, Senator Johnson, and I believe it's Sir Allen. Is that correct?
Let me correct that, because I'm the source of some of that, not knowing all the intricacies of British titles. I have seen the picture of Her Majesty pinning the Order of the British Empire on Adrian, the photograph of it for contributions to the kingdom. It was I who added the appellation, Sir. I think there are several more steps before it's actually Sir. Is that not correct?
It's classed as what we say an OBE, and this is a very high honor, I have to say that. But I'll tell you, so you put it as a suffix to your name, so you don't put your PhDs and the rest of it. If you got one of those, you just put that there. So I'm in America at Newark Airport some time ago, and I'm waiting, and we've got the snow and everything, and there's a lady saying, "Will Mr. Obi come to?" And I'm listening. I thought this some Japanese or something. And then I thought, it can't be, surely not. So I went, and Mr. Obi, it's actually Allen, Adrian Allen. That's the suffix. I beg your pardon. So it does get a bit confusing. So I apologize on that. And I will get into trouble with Her Majesty if you keep pinging Sir. Around,
good. Well, I apologize. Okay. I don't want
to. Don't you apologize. Nobody here apologize. The way you guys have welcomed the efforts, and certainly in my case, that's a lot of the reason I keep coming back to support on this. You all do yourself
and your state to credit the way you've commanded yourself on these type of things. I have to say that. So thank you for your patience on this.
Thank you. Representative Roxman.
Thank you. This is the second time I've seen the presentation. The first was at the Oregon Business Leaders Conference, and it just keeps getting better. And Representative Gomberg is exactly correct. Congratulations to you, Senator. It doesn't matter if it's in Scappoose or if it's in Brookings. What's good for Oregon and what this will bring for Oregon is amazing. So I appreciate all the work.
That's right. Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator, and thank you, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr. Geary, for coming. Appreciate it. My question is, how will the Sheffield facility work with the Oregon facility? Is there some synergy between those two? And then add on to that, what other industries besides aerospace or building flying machines would be attracted to this facility? And we'll discuss how to spell the word center later. But
yeah, we're divided by a common language.
Certain things
I say here that get me into a lot of trouble sometimes, but it's center. So, we have strict links with the Boeing company, and it's our passion, privilege, to wear that name badge. All of our staff have that Boeing emblem. I don't think there's anywhere in the world outside of your company that are allowed to do that. So you have to, well, you don't have to, appreciate this. So in the UK, the aerospace industry is one of the biggest sectors. We have our own big companies in there, Rolls-Royce in particular. Doughties, we do landing gears and things. It's worth billions to our economy. So we have to harness and encompass and get on board ourselves the growth. So we will be doing, in fact, we do. We've always done lots of work, hands across the ocean. But quite honestly, you know this, is I'm looking towards getting a match at a UK level with state funding from here. And I really hope a team comes here to get a federal match. And I think we can do that because there are things out there at a federal level called NNMIs. And I've really got to get my tongue around that at this time in the morning. But National Networks of Manufacturing, and I spoke at the White House a few years ago, and part of that initiative is based on our model as well. And I think we need to get together to go and bid to match that. Put on top of that the fact that my government and, we're just post what we call Brexit. And there's a massive emphasis within the UK to strengthen its links with the USA and the East. And this is an ideal opportunity to bring that together. And I look forward to, and you know this, I've got ministers at trade level from our Department of Trade and Industry that want to go in together, an Anglo-American joint initiative, because there's enough in there for both of us. And I think having that strength and the best brains here, mixing with the best brains over there, you know, we really have a chance to change the paradigm. Some of the stuff we want to research into, quite honestly, given that you're the green state, if with your indigenous expertise in your academia within the materials and metals and similar, that's where we're similar in my region in the UK, just imagine if we can start making hollow aircraft parts. Mm-hmm. What an impact that will do. All transport people are driven by legislation. They have got to reduce emissions going forward. There's REACH compliances. It'll be law that you have to make your vehicles either run hotter, more efficient, one or lighter. And in order to do light, you've got to start looking at developing new materials and the processes with those. We really, really, really have to start now looking 20 years. You know, I've been on with the Scottish Government this morning with my colleague. They're taking a 25-year outlook on development to get into, in their case, some of the primary materials forming for future aircraft systems. So you're going to have to believe we really do genuinely want to go into this together using the collective we from Oregon and the UK.
And just to respond, pardon me, just to respond to your comment about aerospace, if you look on the handout that we provided, the list of the launch partners, Daimler Trucks North America here, $200 million spent in tooling last year alone, not a penny spent in Oregon. OMIC will drive that tooling capability and new and unique tooling opportunities for Daimler Trucks North America to do that. Working with Daimler at OMEC.
Enter your password.
Working with Daimler, that will also answer the questions on tooling that the Boeing company has, and that the Vigor company has, and that the Blount company has. So we will reach across all of the challenging manufacturing needs of all of the manufacturing spaces that are represented, and many more as they come on board, to resolve those challenges.
Thank you.
Great. Well, this is wonderful, and as Senator Johnson noted, I previously worked at Oregon Iron Works, now Vigor, and I do recall that they had a strong need to develop the pipeline of skilled machinists and skilled manufacturing professionals in order to support their expanding portfolio of work, which includes, in addition to it includes transportation vehicles of many types, including watercraft and components for other pieces. So the facility is definitely multimodal in terms of the manufacturing research and development and actual manufacturing support. So it sure seems to meet an acute need that I heard described many years ago, and that you're moving forward really successfully on. For folks who are new to the legislature, and we have a number of them on this panel, the handout that is included on OLIS regarding the project notes that I think in the 2016 legislative session, the legislature supported, I believe it was $10 million total, $7.5 million total in bonding and perhaps some combination of support. And one of the great things that you did at that time is provide sign-on letter opportunities for folks who are not on the Ways and Means Committee to show our endorsement of the value of the project and the need to invest in the project. And this committee has shown great interest in supporting things like investment in the OSU Fermentation Center and the Food Innovation Center, some parts of a different part of our manufacturing infrastructure in Oregon. And if there were a way for us to show our support for your upcoming ask, even though we're not on the Ways and Means Committee, or some of us are, please help us know how we can weigh in a productive way to support that.
Thank you for the invitation, and you will absolutely have a pathway to show your advocacy for this, and all of you will have a vote. Again, in a very austere, very bleak budget scenario, we're going to be asking for an investment, but we believe it's the kind of investment that brings us revenue and inward investment to our state that helps our budget overall in the long term. Adrian just told me this morning that Scotland has made a $100 million commitment. And again, on this long look, building a monorail to their facility, having been on the Sheffield site, parking became a very acute problem very quickly. And now light rail is being built out from the city of Sheffield to service their site. This is a win-win-win deal. And in my wildest imagination, the Sheffield AMRC that I saw was exponentially better than what I dreamed it was going to be. And if we can do this in Oregon, we will all take enormous pride years from now of our participation in changing the Oregon economic landscape.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your leadership. Any further questions for the panel? All right. Well, thank you so much for your great work, and we look forward to supporting it and celebrating it moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With
thank
that,
you.
We'll close the informational hearing on the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2470, Urban Renewal Board Representation, and we'll invite forward Representative Paul Holvey to orient us to the legislation. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to testify on this bill, House Bill 2470. I call it another one of my windmill series of bills, and it is a bill that you probably notice is maybe a little controversial. But in fact, this issue's been around for quite some time, and it was in 2009, and I don't know if I announced myself, State Representative Paul Holvey for the record. My analyst always tells me to remind people of that. So, going back to 2009, there was some overhaul of the urban renewal agency laws, urban renewal districts. And at that time, there was a very robust discussion, and many of the issues didn't quite get fully addressed in my mind, but I think the opponents and proponents agreed to take a rest from the discussion and did pass a bill that I supported and still do support that bill. However, in the meantime, I think there's still some issues of fairness that haven't been dealt with. And so that is one of the reasons I brought House Bill 2470 forward, was to have that discussion again. Urban renewal districts, as you know, are an economic tool for many areas around the state to try to address their blighted areas, and they use tax increment financing, which I'm sure other people will explain a little bit, that is basically authorized in our Oregon Constitution. So I think that it is a good tool oftentimes, and can be useful. The issue that I bring forward, though, is that in tax increment financing, the monies from other taxing districts are the future increases to the value in those particular property values get swept away from those individual taxing districts and go into an urban renewal agency to try to fix blight in their area by incenting development. Now, I'm not against that kind of economic development, nor against that kind of idea. But what I do have trouble with is that the taxing districts that are impacted by this, many of them very small, you know, whether they're fire districts or your local school districts or your counties even, really don't have any say-so on whether or not they agree with their monies being swept into an urban renewal plan or a change to that plan. And for me, I fundamentally have a principle that doesn't seem right to me, because and I'm trying to change that by giving these taxing districts an actual vote if they agreed to have their money swept away into whatever project the urban renewal plan is proposing. And I know there's a formula for who's on the urban renewal agency, and usually these overlapping taxing districts are not on the urban renewal agency. The law does speak to them being consulted on these plans, but they do not have a voice of saying yes or no. And from the way I look at this, taxing districts are set up for a specific mission, specific purpose, and approved by the taxpayers who vote on whether to allow the rates to go up on those taxing districts to put money into the mission, whether it's fighting mosquitoes or fighting fires or running a county or running our schools. So when those monies come out, they're oftentimes a very long time before they return a value back to the taxing district because of the length of time that these urban renewal agencies exist. So when I think about that, because some of them in the past have, I know the city of Eugene once at one point was 60 years old, and in fact they used the money for public buildings, which basically took property out of the taxing rolls. And instead of using a bond and going to the people to build a public library, which is a benefit to the community and a value, I admit, but instead of going to the people and asking for the adequate bonding to build it, they use urban renewal monies to accomplish that task, or to help accomplish that task. And, I'm asking, so when does the other taxing districts see that value come back to them? And they have no say-so over it. And so they, and to me, the voters approve The money is going into that taxing district for a specific purpose. And these taxing districts, all of them, should have some sort of say-so of whether they agree with that. And you'll say, well, they're very small. A mosquito district doesn't, you know, hardly amount to any money, so why should they have a voice? Well, I would submit that each one of those taxing districts should have an equal voice, because even if they're small or big, because the impact to their operations can fundamentally impact their ability to provide the services and fulfill the mission that the voters have said that's what they want that taxing district to do with their money. And so at the very least, I thought, well, I at one point thought that the Urban Renewal Agency should be made up only of one individual from each taxing district. End of story. But that's, the bill does not do that. It just says that each one of them should, you know, have a seat at the table, so to speak, on that. The bill does not eliminate urban renewal districts, and it doesn't eliminate the tax increment financing that's established in the Constitution, but it does give those overlapping taxing districts a voice on whether they agree of having monies come out of their particular taxing district for their mission to subsidize an urban renewal plan. And I will note that when you look at this statewide, you'll note that how much money is coming out of these overlapping taxing districts, including schools, and going into these urban renewal agencies across the state. And, you know, I've heard it said at my school board, it doesn't make any difference, you know, we'll get the money back and it's not going to cost us anything because we get a per pupil distribution from the state. But what it does do is it reduces that pool of money across the whole state, and across all the state students get a, or districts get a, school districts get a reduction in that per pupil distribution. So you'll find many areas around the state that do not have urban renewal districts are actually helping subsidize those urban renewal agencies around the state. You know, in mass, just looking at schools alone. And when we're in real financial trouble about, you know, schools, counties having enough resources and money, you know, it's important that we think about, you know, how we're allowing these monies to go out without a say. So I have a dash one amendment that speaks to, instead of having the taxing districts having a seat on the board, because the taxing districts may be too large to manage or whatever the reason may be, that at least these urban renewal plans and changes to those plans require a vote of the people of all of those taxing districts to approve that. I think
I just want to note that we have a question. So if you're just about finished, that'd be great. But I know that you may be one of our significant substantive experts on the matter. So since it's
I wouldn't call myself an expert on the matter.
Okay.
I followed it for a while, but happy to interrupt my train of thought for Representative Gomberg.
Very good.
Answer whatever question he might have.
Fantastic. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't get me in trouble. I'm appearing before his committee at 1 o'clock this afternoon. thank you, Representative Holvey. Kind of a two-part question. First of all, I'm wondering if we have a jurisdiction with a lot of taxing districts, whether you anticipate any problems with this newly comprised board becoming unwieldy, and similarly, if some small taxing districts choose not to send a representative when your wording says they must be appointed, might we have quorum problems?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's a question we could ask ourselves. You know, if you don't show up in this committee, might you have a quorum problem? And is this committee too unwieldy? You know, I guess that's something that you would have to face. I think taxing districts, you know, folks are concerned about the monies that are coming in for their mission, and I would be surprised if they didn't somehow make their presence. That's why the dash one amendment is a different proposal that says, well, the people should at least approve this, because it's the taxpayers that have decided that their monies should go into that taxing district. So if there's a different use and that money's being swept away without the approval of that taxing district or without a vote of the the people, then, you know, I think that that is, you know, I just don't philosophically think that's the right way government should operate. And so if you have an objection to the unwieldy board, allow the people to make that decision.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks. We've got a question from Representative Clem. Unless, do you want to wrap up your thought before we jump in? I think it's a really important subject, and we have some questions, and probably people have some thoughts to share. So let me know if you're...
Sure, I'm happy to answer questions anytime. Maybe that'll just finish my testimony.
Okay. But all right, then. Representative Clem, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand where we're at. I've got this agenda that talks about one member being added to each urban renewal. When I'm reading the actual bill, it looks like it's more about sending the plan to each district, and then they all would need to approve it. And then I think I'm hearing maybe the amendment is different than both of those, which is you would have each municipality get it. They would conduct a vote of their electors. So the question I've got is, let's say you have let's do an odd number, 11 taxing districts. If it in the envisioned amendment, if it passed in the electorates of 6 and failed in 5, would it pass still, or is it has to pass in every single one?
I believe as the bill is introduced, it would have to pass in each of those taxing districts.
And what are you thinking about on the amendment side?
Well, I mean, except that it's a vote of the people instead
right.
of a representational vote by the members of the member of that taxing district.
But if it were like 10-1, that one would effectively still have veto power over the other 10 in that scenario. I just want to make sure I understand. I'm not trying to make a point. I'm just making
sure. Well, you are making a point, and I think it's a good one. But, yes, that's the way the bill is designed. You know, that one taxing district may be very small, and we can ignore them, but that money that's coming out of it may significantly impact their mission and their ability to provide services, which the voters have already approved of. And they may not agree that their money should be swept away from their mission into something that they have no say-so over.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Brocksmith, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning.
The veto power question, I appreciate that. So having been a former city councilor and stopping, actually, an urban renewal district from coming into the city of Port Orford because of a lot of the things that you've discussed here today with regards to the dollars that would be going to one entity to provide services, but as you move forward, where you say that the other entities don't have say so, but in reality, they do in a way, because the other taxing districts are elected by the same people that are in the community or region. So, for example, I sit on the school board still. And that would be, so if the city of Port Orford wanted to enact an urban renewal district, they could, but I also sat on the city council of the city of Port Orford. So I guess what I'm saying is having veto power by one taxing district determined by, we have 42 special taxing districts in Curry County alone, it could cause some serious problems if everyone has to be on board rather than a majority. Is that a stickler in your bill that would not...
I think thank you for the question, Chair Leininger and Vice Chair Brocksmith. You know, I think that, you know, that's something people can talk about. You know, I'm not going to say that there's no wiggle room in this proposal. I'm just laying out my fundamental philosophy on this and why I believe that taxing districts should have a voice, because the voters have basically said, here's the money for this taxing district. We want you to do this. And then without the approval of that taxing district and without the approval of the voters, though they may have agreed to the plan originally, they may not agree to that individual future project or the future of that plan going forward, because their budgets may be so strained that this this could have a long-lasting impact on their ability to deliver services. And to me, many of those times, you know, the urban renewal groups, you know, have other methods of going to the voters and asking for a levy or, you know, doing something else, some other type of incentive instead of taking it from other taxing districts. So, you know, it's still a good tool. I'm not saying that it can't be used. And if it's really a great idea and everybody sees the value in it and they can afford it out of their budget, you know, I would assume that they'd all support it, and it would all be fine. But yeah. I become really troubled when I see how much money has gone out of school districts into urban renewal development projects, many of which are just great and will someday return value. But in the meantime, those agencies are suffering, and, you know, I think that they should be able to say, wait a second, we just can't afford this right now. You know, I think that's just a fundamental principle for me. Yeah. And so I guess that's my point.
So Representative Lewis, and then I'm going to make a comment, and then we're going to transition to a number of people who we have signed up to testify. I want to note, though, just before we launch into the next couple of comments, that I've asked Mr. Crawford to put together an urban renewal sort of fact sheet for us so that people have a sense of the quantum of resource that is moving out of the places that would otherwise receive it to support urban renewal projects, because I think that's important, and I'm not sure we have that in the record right now. And this is not our only opportunity to have this conversation, and in fact the bill has a subsequent referral to House Committee on Revenue. So we don't have a ton of time to ventilate all the issues today, but this is a great introduction. Representative Lewis, please ask your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the statute that creates the board for the agency, and I see in here that there is the ability right now, if a local jurisdiction wants to do it, to put members of other taxing districts on the board. I mean, it's an option that they can choose. Can you address that?
Well, I can address, certainly it's in statute and it's an option. I just, you know, I think you'll hear from some special districts who don't get that opportunity, that it's at the control of the urban renewal agencies, oftentimes a city, you know, to pick who's on the board. And so, you know, though it may be allowed in statute, in practice, does it really happen? And I would argue, you know, you can look at how tax increment financing works academically, theoretically, and all these charts, and it all looks really great. But I think the reality of practice and the experience of these many of these taxing districts is really a lot different than how it's, you know, theoretically proposed. So, you know, I just think that we need to be cognizant of the impacts to taxing districts that are, you know, in my mind, helping subsidize oftentimes good projects, but sometimes projects that they may not be in favor of, that they don't see a great value in. And those impacts, I think, are serious. And I, you know, it again is this cost shift, you know, from areas of the state that don't have urban renewal districts into areas of the state that do have urban renewal districts. And, you know, that's
important.
That's something that I think, you know, we should look at as a whole state. So
I think that's a great point. So, you know, I want to, before we transition to the next comments, I want to note that my experience as a former Clackamas County Commissioner was really poignant on this issue. We in Clackamas County had an incredibly caustic set of interactions over the use of urban renewal from between maybe 2011 and 2012. And the result of it was that there was a measure, and it unified the right and the left. So this was at a time when the control of the Clackamas County Board was transitioning to a different majority party, and people on the right and the left were all rising up in incredible anguish or frustration over what they perceived to be diversion of revenue from urban renewal because of urban renewal projects at Clackamas Town Center, and even though there's been some great work in Clackamas County because of those, away from special districts, schools, public safety, and we have a whole bunch of special districts in Clackamas, but those were some of the most poignant stories. And a culmination of it was that the voters of Clackamas County ended up voting that unincorporated the entirety of Clackamas County has to from now on vote on whether any urban renewal district may be created in unincorporated Clackamas County, which is roughly half the population, which, and I fought that, and we lost. But in my assessment, that kills the use of urban renewal in Clackamas County's unincorporated areas forever. So that's a really powerful, you know, if we do nothing, I mean, I support urban renewal. I support infrastructure development projects. I fought on the front line of trying to protect urban renewal, and we lost in response to a joint effort of people on the right and the left who were feeling concerned about it. I think Representative Holvey is signaling that you're interested in trying to address what may be excesses of the program, and that you're not committed to either the original format of the bill or necessarily even the dash one, but you think that something needs to be done. And I would say that based on my experience, the cost of doing nothing may be the cost of losing the tool. And some other communities have retained the tool by doing some other things. And there's no doubt also that there's one major urban area in our state that I believe radically disproportionately is the one that diverts resource from the other, you know, from the school fund and others by its use of urban renewal. And it's done some good things for property values in that city, but, you know, it's a reasonable question for us to be asking. And again, this is not our only opportunity to have this conversation, but what we do next is a really valid question, that it's not the domain of the left or of the right. And now that we know that we're really suffering in terms of revenue for schools and crucial safety services and things, it's a good time to be doing it. Doesn't change the fact that Rondler Acres was an incredible success story of the use of urban renewal. And one of the reasons that we have the great, is it Intel that was cited as a result of some great urban renewal work there? I mean, there are some great examples of it being used well, but one of the most important revenue allocation conversations of our time in the legislature is going to be this issue. So thanks for that intro. We'll have more conversation.
I would just like to add one thing before I leave. Yeah. I appreciate that I do know that urban renewal districts oftentimes succeed. Yeah. But sometimes I think that they attribute their success to the monies from that taxing district. And I think sometimes that's hard to really say that whether or not that project would have happened with or without those monies. They are incentives. The question is, were they really needed all the time? So I think that question is debatable, but I do prefer the dash one amendment, because at the very least I think that people have a right to either agree or disagree with the actions of the Urban Renewal Agency.
Yeah.
So that's where I will leave it, and
thank you very much. Sure, appreciate it. And with that, we'll invite forward Kyle Gorman and Genoa Ingram. And then we'll invite forward Susan Walkey and Justin Douglas and Elaine Howard afterwards. So, you know, if it were possible for you to all keep your comments to about 3 minutes, that would help the maximum number of people present. I know you have a presentation, though, Mr. Gorman, so feel free to take a little extra time, but thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kyle Gorman. I represent no one today, and I have opposition or support of the bill. My goal here today is to provide a sort of a primer on urban renewal. I do support the Manufacturing Innovation Center. That was awesome, and I don't know if it's fair to say I'm gobsmacked by that presentation, but it was quite spectacular. So what I want to do is just give you sort of a history and background, a definition of the terms of urban renewal. So as you work through this process, I expect that this or other bills may be important. My background is that I was on the front lines from the fire district side of urban renewal issues. And in the context of that, we formed an agreement in 2009 with AORA, the Oregon Urban Renewal Agencies. And we established an Urban Renewal Oversight Committee, which I co-chaired, which sort of managed or at least oversaw the implementation of 3056 that was passed in 2009 and made some statutory changes to urban renewal. So what is urban renewal? It's a way to repair blight. And what is blight? And that is no one really knows. It's not defined very well in the statute, but in essence, it's anything that can restrict or impede economic development, whether it's transportation or whether it's subsurface infrastructure like pipes, sewer pipes or water pipes, or whether it's in the case of Eugene, for example, maybe it's not having high-speed internet. In the early 50s, the legislature established legislation enabling urban renewal, and it wasn't until 1960 that tax increment financing was actually authorized as a use of financing. So I want to make a distinction between the two words. Urban renewal does not mean tax increment financing. Tax increment financing is a method to finance urban renewal projects. We often use them interchangeably, but I want to make sure that you can have urban renewal without having tax increment financing. And I think it's tax increment financing that is the polarizing issue for most agencies. In 2001, a local option levies and bonds were exempted from a division of taxes under urban renewal. I'll talk about division of taxes in a second.
You know what, Mr. Gorman, I'm going to jump in here. So I think I wanted to note to folks that we're going to hold over the Business Oregon audit presentation and response due to not having enough time. But I am going to ask that you wrap up your presentation, Mr. Gorman, by 5 after, and then we are going to ask other folks to speak for about 3 minutes each. We have a written presentation from you. And again, I think this won't be our only conversation on urban renewal, but I sure appreciate this good document you've got for us. Thanks.
Okay, so an urban renewal agency is created by either a city or a county, sometimes one other agency within a county, but typically a city or county board. The board is almost always the county board or the city commission. The agency creates a plan. The plan lists the projects, the dollars involved, the governance, the financing methods, and typically, again, tax increment financing is used, and there's a whole bunch of statutory rules for how they have to have public input and proceed with the plan. Typically, the types of projects that we see in urban renewal is construction or improvement of streets, again, subsurface infrastructure. There's some rehabilitation of buildings. There's acquisition of properties. Sometimes there's store frontage improvements. But basically, and this is important, is it's bricks and mortar projects only. So you can't use urban renewal dollars to fund vehicle maintenance, to buy fire trucks, to buy furniture, that kind of stuff. It's bricks and mortar. So when it's implemented, the municipality picks a boundary. They establish this maximum indebtedness. And what maximum indebtedness means is the amount of total expenditures that the municipality can spend on urban renewal. So they typically spend by indebting themselves first, but so just think of maximum indebtedness as maximum expenditures. It caps values, so all of the assessed value in the area established by the municipality is frozen at that time. And the overlapping taxing districts continue to receive taxes on that frozen base. And anything that any increment over time, as the property values grow, the increment over time is diverted to the urban renewal agency. So that's why they call it tax increment financing. It's a tax on the increment once the assessed values are frozen. The agency typically collects typically bonds and then uses the tax increments for funding. Funding their projects. So What the goal really is to attract private investment, property values increase, and you have an increased assessed value. The agency collects taxes on the increments, pays off their bonds, and other taxing entities continue to share the frozen base. They lose all of the intrinsic growth, the 3% growth that you might have every year. And they also lose any investment over and above that 3%. When the plan is completed, the properties go back on the tax rolls at their new higher values. And that's one of the things that's really touted heavily about urban renewal. On your tax bill, urban renewal, in most cases, will not directly affect your tax bill. So you will pay the same amount of taxes. Those taxes are just going to different areas. So this is the effect of urban renewal over, say, a 30-year period. And if you're a fire district, then your taxes are frozen at year one, and you receive taxes in the pink for that period of time. And all of the assessed value that's green in this chart will go to the urban renewal agency. Now, the urban renewal proponents will say, yes, perfect. At the end of this 30 years, then we've got twice as much, 2.5 times as much value coming on to the tax rolls, or hopefully even more if there is investment in that during that time. For overlapping taxing districts, I think these are the issues, and this is what causes friction between urban renewal agencies and overlapping taxing districts. 30 seconds. The types of projects, municipal buildings. Fire districts typically don't want to spend fire district money to build city halls, for example. The amount of maximum indebtedness, because it's the maximum indebtedness that drives everything. The length of time of the projects, how soon the maximum indebtedness can be recovered. The timelines. Urban renewal does not establish timelines. When the money is spent, the urban renewal plan ends. So it could be 40 years, it could be 10 years, depending on how successful it is. Program extensions. Most overlapping agencies don't like to see urban renewal plan be successful and then extend itself without resetting the value to zero. Governance. The governance is it's an offshoot of the city or county, and almost always it's just a proxy for the mayor and city council votes. And finally, the but-for rule, and this is the question that we all ask is, but for urban renewal, would this have happened? And nobody has really answered that question. We don't know. We do know that generally in the state of Oregon, assessed values increase more outside of urban renewal areas than they do within. That's it.
Thank you. I think that's helpful. It is really a complicated tool. Ms. Ingram.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My written testimony is before you. There, I see no need to go over it. I just want to make one point out of respect for your time. I first wanted to thank everyone who took the time to meet with me, some of you several times, and I do appreciate that on behalf of the fire districts. I am Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. And the one point I would like to make is that the fire district directors are very pro-business. This is not an us and them discussion. Most of our fire district directors are business people. The president of the fire district directors is currently a building contractor. Our members are, we have architects on the board, we have attorneys on our boards, people who manage storefronts and shopping centers, et cetera. So we see this bill as an opportunity to start the discussion. We're not married to either the First Amendment that you see before you or the bill as written. We see this as a vehicle to start the conversation and see how fire districts in particular and other special districts can continue to provide the services that they have been asked to provide and still be pro-development, working hand in hand with the business community, their chambers of commerce, et cetera. We thank you for hearing the bill, and we urge you to move it forward so that conversation can continue.
Thank you. We have a question from Rep. Brocksmith.
Thank you. You mentioned that most of the urban renewal dollars go to infrastructure projects, correct? Street,
generally speaking, yes.
Underground lighting, you know, street project, what have you. But then your final statement was that the assessed values increase faster outside of the URD than within.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
I don't understand how that's even possible. If that's why, because you're investing in the, you know, infrastructure to make things better within the URD, how in the world would it?
First, not all urban renewal agencies are created equal, and of course you're dealing specifically with blighted areas, which are harder to get restarted sometimes. So if they're younger urban renewal agencies, they might not be growing as fast. But here's the data from the Department of Revenue. 3.5% growth in statewide in urban renewal assessed value, 3.5% growth. Statewide for all of Oregon, 4.6% growth. So 30% more growth for all of Oregon as opposed to what's inside urban renewal areas. And of course, the all of Oregon actually includes the urban renewal areas too. So that number is probably dragged down a little bit by the existence of urban renewal. So I think it's a confounding issue. And I think that, like I say, not all urban renewal areas are equal, so I think there's some qualitative factors. But when you have some of these really ancient urban renewal areas that we have in Oregon, like in Salem, in Medford, in Portland in particular, that are in some cases over 40 years old, you know, their ability to achieve much growth over and above that is pretty limited. In Salem, the waterfront urban renewal area, established in 1975. It's 42 years old, and it grew at 2.7% last year.
Thank you. All right, great. Thank you for your presentation. And next up, we'll have Susan Walkie, Justin Douglas, and Elaine Howard, please. Makes sense. Welcome. Please begin in any order, but state your name for the record, and we're trying to keep people within 3 minutes so that we can get all the way through this set of witnesses. Thanks.
Do you want to introduce yourself first?
Okay. Good morning, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name's Susan Walkie, and I'm the chair of the Lincoln City Urban Renewal Agency. I'm also the downtown manager for the Bay Area Merchants Association, which is in the south end of Lincoln City. Should I?
Go ahead. You know, actually, go ahead and give your remarks, and then okay. We'll proceed to the next people. Thanks.
Okay. I'm here today to testify before you in opposition to House Bill 2470. Lincoln City has one urban renewal district created in 1988 that runs the full length of town, centered around Highway 101, which serves as our main street. The district has accomplished numerous public infrastructure improvement projects and community visioning for four of our six historic business districts, or PEARLs, which further prioritized an ambitious urban renewal plan into manageable community and stakeholder-driven projects. Some examples include upgrades to pump stations, water and sewer lines, streetscapes, sidewalks, beach accesses, public restrooms, and undergrounding of overhead power lines. Additionally, the agency has offered a 0% interest facade improvement loan program, which has created a revolving fund to help business and property owners enhance curb appeal and make needed repairs. This program has made over 40 loans since 1999, totaling over $1.8 million. While much of what Lincoln City's Urban Renewal Agency has done is economic development through a substantial amendment to the plan in 2009, the agency expanded its ability to offer additional loan and grant tools. This includes partnering with Energy Trust of Oregon for a 0% interest energy efficiency loan and with the Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments in offering a 0 to 2% interest business expansion loan. The agency's local program support grant offers funds to local economic development partners. The Oregon Coast Community College's Small Business Development Center has received about $20,000 a year over the past 4 years for scholarships to businesses and their employees located in the Urban Renewal District. When the agency realized the district had set too short a timeline to reach its 1988 maximum indebtedness amount of $43 million, a 2014 substantial amendment extended the ability to collect the remaining $7 million of tax increment through a voluntary underlevy. As the district wraps up its projects, it is giving 80% back through revenue sharing to the overlapping taxing jurisdictions. Lincoln City is a small town, and our Urban Renewal Agency communicates regularly and works well with the city, county, and overlapping taxing jurisdictions who know best about how to collaborate to ensure successful project implementation and well-rounded community-based economic development.
Thank you.
Please don't let legislation that would undermine local control and slow progress for urban renewal, a vital economic development tool for small towns with big dreams.
Great. Thank you so much. And I just want to note that on deck we have Mark Landauer, Lori Satin-Spiel, and Doug Schmidt, please.
Good morning, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony this morning on House Bill 2470. My name is Justin Douglas. I'm the policy manager for the Portland Development Commission. We are the City of Portland's Economic Development and Redevelopment Agency. I also have the honor of serving as the president of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. If you hear me say AORA, that's what it's referring to. AORA is a statewide membership organization since 1987. That represents redevelopment agencies across the state, from Astoria to Albany, from LeGrand to Lebanon, from Talent to Tigard. One of AORA's primary objectives is to promote best practices among the state's urban renewal agencies. And so in 2014, we drafted the best practices for urban renewal agencies in Oregon. This is essentially a plain-spoken version of Oregon Revised Statutes 457. So in that, it's very helpful for people to understand the statute and how to implement it appropriately. The best practices document talks about how urban renewal works, procedural requirements, and throughout there are best practice tips from experienced practitioners, including local district managers, consultants, urban renewal attorneys, and bond counsel. And I'd like to note that in drafting the best practices document, AORA did collaborate with the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon School Boards Association, which drafted a letter that's an exhibit to the document, and they basically stated that urban renewal should be a targeted and responsible, it's best used when targeted and responsibly. I'd say if there's one message in the best practices document, it's that urban renewal agencies have a responsibility and an obligation to be good partners and to communicate the value of our work. AORA feels that this House Bill 2470 would hamper local economic development and redevelopment activities, and we feel that through the best practices manual, through regular conferences, and an active and dedicated board, we can ensure that municipalities across the state are using urban renewal as appropriate tool to deliver on local objectives, and that the current requirement to consult with taxing jurisdictions is the appropriate way to ensure good local partnerships. Just very briefly, taking off my AORA hat, I'd like to talk a little bit about how the Portland Development Commission is working in close collaboration with our taxing jurisdiction partners. So, for example, in 2011, the Portland City Council approved 6 micro urban renewal districts, and we call this the Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative Program. And this is one of the most popular programs that we offer, because it basically provides resources for local community economic development. We provide grants, training, and support to each district, and each district is responsible for planning and implementing projects to meet their unique needs. And I mention this because when these districts were created, not only did PDC engage Multnomah County up front in the process during the creation of the plans, but the county actually agreed to dedicate its portion of the tax increment revenue share that would go to their general fund into these NPI districts to deliver on shared objectives. One other quick example, in 2015, PDC, at the request of Mayor Hales and our city council, led an overhaul of urban renewal across the city. It terminated two districts, reduced two others, and then expanded two more. Multnomah County and Portland Public Schools were at the table throughout the process. We had an approximately 20-member advisory committee that met for about 6 months before the formal requirement for the consultant confer, and both representatives from Multnomah County and Portland Public attended at PDC Board of Commissioners meetings and the Portland City Council to testify in support of these amendments. So the point of these anecdotes is to convey to you that in Portland, the relationship that we have with taxing jurisdictions is solid and built on communication and transparency. So in conclusion, I'd like to state that both AORA and the City of Portland respectfully oppose House Bill 2470. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Elaine Howard. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, Chair Leninger, and committee. I am a consultant who for the last 12 years has specialized in urban renewal across the state of Oregon. I've prepared 29 new urban renewal plans, 46 amendments, 15 feasibility studies, and numerous other minor amendments, working with over 40 urban renewal areas across the state of Oregon. Urban renewal has been a very effective tool in Oregon used by cities and counties to help improve their vitality. The Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, AORA, website features individual fact sheets on numerous successful projects that incorporated funding from tax increment, as well as leveraging it with other funding sources. If you haven't gone on that website and looked at those projects, it would be great to do that, because it will give you a good idea of the ability of urban renewal to do projects within your communities. Some of those include assistance to the Liberty Theater in Astoria, the Face Rock Creamery in Bandon, the Pelican Brewery Company in Tillamook, all of which help spur economic activity in these coastal cities. Hood River and Lebanon have used urban renewal to provide infrastructure necessary to allow for significant development in their communities. Lake Oswego is partnering with local developers to provide downtown commercial uses and housing development. They are also using tax increment to help leverage a public-approved bond to reconstruct Boone's Ferry Road to assist the businesses along that highway. There are many, many more examples of successful use of urban renewal throughout Oregon. While working with these communities, my firm strongly encourages working with the impacted taxing districts. The taxing district with the largest impact itself is always the city. For example, in Jacksonville, the division of taxes for the city of Jacksonville is 9.32% of their permanent rate levy, while for any other taxing district, it is under 0.45% of their permanent rate levy. So the impacts are vastly different for all of the other impacted taxing jurisdictions versus the city itself who implements urban renewal. For most countywide districts, it is less than 0.19% of their permanent rate levy. Although this is real money, it is a much lower percentage impact than the impact on the city itself. Since the 2009 urban renewal legislation, cities have been much more proactive in involving taxing districts in decisions on new urban renewal plans and substantial amendments. Most new urban renewal plans and substantial amendments are preceded with advice from an advisory committee, typically having a fire district on that committee, typically inviting school districts to be represented on those committees. School districts are typically not opposed to urban renewal. Of all the plans and amendments on which I have worked, there has only been one opposition by a school district on a plan or an amendment. When asked to participate in the committees, they are very willing to do that. And in many instances, the schools are very supportive of urban renewal because they realize that a better, stronger, thriving community will mean growth in their community and growth in housing development, and therefore hopefully growth in number of students that attend their schools, and that is the basis on which they receive their present funding.
That's great. And you know, we have about 1 minute left for you.
And that's all I have.
Great. So. Perfect.
In addition to serving on advisory committees, taxing districts receive a statutorily required consult and confer letter for every new plan and substantial amendment. It is extremely rare for the city to receive any negative input from an impacted taxing district. There have been instances, many instances, where the districts have negotiated. The fire district has been very involved in many of the communities in which I work, and those decisions have been able to be resolved at the local level. So I believe that House Bill 2470 is unnecessary. I think that cities are doing a great job of consult and confer. I think when there are tasking districts who are really interested, they are coming to the table and resolving issues locally. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, let's now hear from Mark Landauer, Lori Satenspiel, and Douglas Schmidt. And then on deck we have Sandy
Rumugo.
And Doug Riggs and Eric Kanzler. We're trying to make sure that people who've traveled fairly far get in the lineup quite soon. And then I think if everyone stays within about 3 minutes, we should be able to cover the whole list maybe with 5 minutes. Overflow past our time, so anyone who absolutely must leave may. Mr. Landauer, would you like to begin?
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and you've had a pretty robust conversation already, and I'll try not to repeat anything, but the big issue for us is obviously the diversion of revenue that dilutes our ability to provide services at the levels that we've our citizens expect. And this diversion can last for many years, decades, up to 52 years in one case. We don't oppose urban renewal when it's done properly. I mean, there is a return on investment, and you can see that very starkly on North McAdam in downtown Portland, where there was no development whatsoever, and now we have glass towers. I mean, it can work when it's done properly, but there is a diversion of money that does have an impact on our ability to serve the people we're dedicated to doing. I want to give you some examples where our members tear their hair out. City halls, police stations, libraries pay for businesses so that they can pay their water, sewer, and rent. These are all examples that have occurred since 2009's legislation. $250,000 for furniture in a city hall. $50,000 for software at a city hall. $2.5 million for a parking lot. An additional $700,000 to fix that parking lot because they constructed it poorly. $1.6 million for another parking lot rehabilitation. A fire station for the city. And here's a great one, grants to business owners who happen to actually sit on the Urban Renewal Board. These are the kind of examples that need oversight. There is no oversight at the state level for urban renewal. We made progress in 2009. But there are still some outrageous things that are occurring, and we need help. We need the legislature to provide guidance to some of these agencies who are spending money in a manner that we feel does not return the investment to the districts that are paying into this scheme. With that, I'll just end my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks very much.
Chair Leininger, Lori Satenspiel for the Oregon School Boards. I think most of my case has been put forward by everyone here. already. School districts are impacted as well, as was mentioned. And we want to be good partners, and I appreciate the panel before who lined out very well the best practices, and school districts have been a piece of, and a part of that. I also wanted to mention the revenue that's lost off the tax rolls. And just to put a pretty clear point on this, one of the largest taxing areas here in the state is $41 million a year, rough estimate. That impacts the whole state. We have an equalized funding formula. Okay, so that goes out, the revenue comes in, and then it goes back out through the formula. So that even though it's just one local area, it's felt throughout the state. We are all taxing districts. We want to remain working together and committed to the discussion and how we move forward with some oversight. One case, City of Tualatin was renewing. They actually came to the school board meeting and presented, and it was awesome. So we do appreciate that, and we want to continue to be a part of the discussion. Be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have questions? I actually have a question for you before you jump in, Mr. Schmidt. Do you have a figure on the amount of money annually diverted from the state school funds because of urban renewal, or biannually?
Chair, the last number I heard was $150 million, but it hasn't been updated in a couple of years. Is that?
That's $150 million a year. So it's okay. That's
helpful. I can follow up with you offline and get that number, if that would be helpful.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions on that? All right, Mr. Schmidt, thank you.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, OSACA. We're neutral on the urban renewal part of this, but the last part of the bill deals with allowing taxing districts to tax-exempt properties, and we are opposed to that because of the difficulty and complexity of administering that. And just as a real quick example, I'm going to use enterprise zones, which is one of the statutes that was mentioned. If you have an enterprise zone, we have a business that comes in, the city approves it. The first year, they may have a $250,000 value added, maybe a piece of equipment or an improvement. If under this bill, the city would probably go ahead and have that piece of equipment be exempt, and maybe a couple of smaller taxing districts, because it wouldn't bring in hardly any money. So with that, we would have to create a new tax code area. And for those of you new to property tax, the tax code area is just the districts that show up on your tax bill. If you look at all of them, you could have the cities, schools, county, cemetery districts. Those are the districts that are in a tax code area. So we would have to create a new tax code area for the districts that choose not to have that property exempt and collect tax on it with that $250,000. So maybe there's eight districts, four of them decide they want to collect tax. So four districts would be in a new tax code area with $250,000 of value. So the next year, the enterprise zone, the business expands greatly to maybe they add $100,000, $100 million improvements. And this time, the city still says we don't want to collect taxes, but maybe those two little districts decide they want to. Well, we have to create another tax code area for those two districts with the $100 million in it. And the first four districts would have $100,250,000 in value. We have to send out tax statements. So, in summary, we ask that the last part of this bill, the dealing with exempting or allowing property taxing districts to tax-exempt property, be removed.
Okay, that's helpful input. Thank you. Thank you to this panel. We I think are looking to put together a fact sheet on the impacts of urban renewal, so I may have Mr. Crawford reach out to one or both of you to get some information from you about the quantum of revenue that is used in other places. All right, thanks. So now we have Sandy Rumugu and Eric Kanzler and Doug Riggs. And on deck, we have Wendy Johnson and Sean Ferrelli. And then we have two people signed up from the city of Salem If we were to have one of those two, either Steve McCoyd or Kristen Rutherford, come forward, then I bet we would be very close to fitting within our allowable time period. Great. And we'd like to have each of you take no more than 3 minutes, please, for your remarks.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Mayer, if you'd like to go first, we'd be honored.
Okay. Thank you. I am Sandy Rumugu, Mayor of Newport, and with me I have asked Derek Tokos, our Director of Community Development and Planning, to come with me. So, Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to give testimony in opposition to House Bill 2470. The city of Newport has for decades, and I can say I've lived there for all those decades, used tax increment financing available under the urban renewal statutes as a tool to reinvest in its infrastructure and civic buildings and to engage in strategic partnerships that have improved the economic health of our community. We have accomplished this through collaboration, and I really want to underline collaboration with affected taxing entities, and it is our firm belief that the investments made have been a catalyst for development and employment that has led to more tax revenue than would otherwise have been realized had this tool been unavailable. And examples include the Oregon Coast Aquarium, a revitalized Nye Beach Business District, the Newport Performing Arts Center, the Newport Visual Arts Center, and most recently, the infrastructure to support the NOAA Mach-P facility and OMSI's Coastal Discovery Center. These urban renewal investments have shaped the community we live in for the better, and they are the only source of funding that we have that can be leveraged, again, leveraged in this manner. HB 2470 could take this away.
Thank you so much. I'm going to ask you to wrap up now because we have 10 minutes left and we have about seven people we'd like to hear from.
Okay, that was my long paragraph.
All right.
Okay. Over the last 5 years, Newport has closed a large urban renewal district and created two smaller districts. A second urban renewal district will be closed in 10 years. These decisions have been made as a result, again, of a collaboration with affected taxing districts, and we believe the existing state law requiring consultation and input from affected taxing districts to be sufficient. We agree with the chair that this is a complicated issue and that more conversation regarding this probably would be beneficial, and we would like to be a part of that conversation.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm afraid we're not going to be able to hear from you, sir, but Mr. Cancellor, Mr. Riggs, if you have something written you'd like to submit, you're welcome to.
All right, thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Eric Cancellor, here representing the City of Bend. So the city is opposed to House Bill 2470 in its current form. From our perspective, urban renewal is a critical tool, not just to fund needed infrastructure, as you've heard numerous times already, but in our case in particular, to provide much needed incentives for affordable housing and for vertical mixed-use development. The city has two existing urban renewal areas, and among their various focuses is affordable housing. Moreover, we plan to use this tool to support the implementation of the city's new urban growth boundary, which, among other things, requires significant increases in density inside the city. In particular, we plan to use, are very likely to use, urban renewal to renovate our central area. This is the area along 3rd Street, if you're familiar with Bend. It used to be the primary state highway through town. When the overpass went in, it was basically repurposed as a community corridor. The resulting redevelopment has yet to occur. It's been a long process to plan for that, and we are anticipating that urban renewal will play a significant role in that process and, among other things, provide many hundreds of mostly attached housing units that will largely be affordable. So It's also worth pointing out that the city of Bend has successfully used urban renewal to renovate the downtown, and we have successfully sunsetted that project. And I think most of you are probably familiar with the downtown. So just to end here, a more global point about our city finances is that the incentives provided by urban renewal help to ensure that our infrastructure funding needs, particularly streets, don't fall to an already overburdened general fund, which, of course, when that happens, also spills over into police and fire and other critical services. On the last note, and on a personal note, my ex-wife is a public high school teacher, and we're still close. We talk about things all the time, and I know that over the years, she has had quite a few homeless students or underhoused, depending on how you want to define the terminology. Bend's vacancy rate is still significantly below 1%, and so our ability to use this tool to impact affordable housing absolutely would have a benefit in terms of educational attainment at a local level.
Thank you so much. Mr. Riggs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs. I have submitted a written testimony on behalf of the city of West Lynn. I'm also representing the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which includes all nine cities in Deschutes, Crook, Jefferson County, plus Maupin. So I have 10 cities. I'll just make two quick points here. The first is that I know of no instances in my area in rural Oregon where we have not consulted actively with our school districts and with the other districts in the area. As many of the witnesses have mentioned, including the mayor from Newport, this is not something that we do in a vacuum. This is not something we impose on special districts. In my areas, we have been very actively involved in working collaboratively with districts. Second point I'd make is that if I'm a school district or if I'm a city, my goal is fixing urban blight, improving the economic situation, and hopefully improving the situation for workers and families in our region. When an area is improved and economic development occurs, job growth and property tax values and income tax values increase. And that's not only true in the small area that we set aside with the boundaries of an urban renewal district, but also outside. So we might develop a small area with urban renewal, but a business comes into that area, and people live outside the area, more business come in, tax revenues are increased, and that's good for school districts, for fire districts, et cetera. Last point I make is really quick about the underlying bill. I don't think anywhere in the Constitution says we run a country by a minority vote. We run a country by a majority vote. If a bill comes before this committee, nine of you vote yes and one of you votes no, the nine carries the bill and it goes on to the House floor. So I don't think that the intent of the bill as introduced was to allow minority rule, but we need to be very careful in addressing that section to ensure that we have the majority of people in an area supporting something and that is able to move forward. So I know there's been lots of testimony. I won't dwell any further, but I appreciate the committee's indulgence.
Thanks. It's that's helpful and clear. Really appreciate it. All right. We have one last panel. Thank you so much. Do we have questions for this panel, anyone? All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. We have one last panel, and I'm going to ask that members of our committee who can stay a few minutes late, please do so. Otherwise, if you have a pre-existing meeting, I understand. And then we will invite forward Sean Ferrelli, Wendy Johnson with the League of Cities, and then we have both Kristen Rutherford and Steve McCoy of the City of Salem signed up. If you both want to come forward and split your 3 minutes or have one of you come forward, we are grateful for your being here and wish we had even more time to offer. Thank you. You may speak in any order. Thank you for your patience and for your participation.
Well, I'll go first. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. My name is Steve McCoy. I'm the council president of the Salem City Council also a member of the Salem Urban Renewal Agency Board. So we're here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2470. To give you some structure, we have seven urban renewal areas in Salem, and the Urban Renewal Agency Board is made up of the same individuals that serve on the City Council. Salem also has 12 overlapping taxing districts, some representing as little as 3/100ths of 1%, 5/100ths of 1%, and 2/800ths of 1% of the property tax increment that goes to urban renewal. To provide each of these effective taxing districts with a seat on the Urban Renewal Agency Board is impractical for administering urban renewal and delivering the mission of the Urban Renewal Agency. And we found that urban renewal is one of the few tools that cities have to engage in economic development activities. And if the committee is seeking, if a company is seeking an urban renewal grant or infrastructure construction to make their project feasible, they need fast assurance and certainty from the Urban Renewal Agency Board that these financial commitments can be met. If 12 taxing districts were added to our Urban Renewal Agency Board, or if we were requiring elections by those folks to get a decision made, those deals wouldn't be made. We'd be off the list very quickly. A case in point certainly for Salem is our Mill Creek Corporate Center. It was founded in 2005 when the state of Oregon had some excess property that they no longer needed. We formed the Urban Renewal District to work with the state to develop land that's about a mile west of or east of I-5, access to there. And that was to develop the infrastructure needed to develop the property. Since then, we've got FedEx, Home Depot, warehousing centers. Hennessy Cold Storage is currently under construction at $27 million. And this summer, PAC Trust will break ground on new spec industrial buildings, something we've needed desperately in Salem for a long time. And that's well over $100 million in investment in the last 10 years. And those are the kinds of issues where we need agility to deal with that fact, because we're not competing on a local basis. It's a regional and sometimes national basis where people are looking for somewhere to site. And if we've got to wait a month or have an election, they're moving on to the next folks, and we're out of running for that kind of a investment. So in closing, the city has a long history of close communication with our effective taxing districts, and specifically that'd be the county and the school district for us that we really work closely with. In fact, we have a monthly meeting with the county commissioners and staff. You're welcome to come down to Sassy Onion tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock and have sparkling repartee and find out what happens with the local government folks meet to talk about this kind of thing. We also meet very closely and work very closely with the school district. So in closing, we think the system works. I would also say we were working on, as a city council, a new police facility here in the Salem, and one of the issues that came up was we could take some of our urban renewal money to help build that structure. It was a resounding no from the city council, which is also the Urban Renewal Board. No, we're not going to do that. That money is not for. We're also currently looking at a set of guidelines that we're going to use when we look at an investment in terms of ratios of percentages, minimum percentage is 4-to-1 in this case or more, private investment to get the money, and paybacks with the tax increment. So we're looking at these things, addressing it. We think this is burdensome, unnecessary, and we would hope you'd not support this.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and also thank you for your service, Mr. Council President. All right, we've got two more witnesses. Thank you so much for being here.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League opposes the bill, and as well as the Dash One Amendment. Over 70 cities have urban renewal districts. Some are older and some are newer. Obviously, they're in small cities, they're in large cities. You've heard a testimony from the larger cities today, but they really do affect our small cities in all parts of the state. When they make these decisions to form these urban renewal districts, that's not taken lightly, as previous testimony explained. It's coming off of the revenue that would be coming into the city that would be paying for services as well. And so it's not an easy decision. And it does affect the other taxing districts, but it's not an easy one to make, and those plans are dealt with carefully. You've mentioned that you'll be asking staff for some numbers. And I caution you that this is what I want to add to the conversation, is that Measure 5 and Measure 50 have really made your number crunching incredibly difficult. We're in compression in most of the state, whether you're a city or county or school district. And so, for example, I have information from Lane County that one of the school districts there is actually ahead because of the urban renewal district, because it counts towards local government and not towards the school. And so when you try to crunch those numbers, you're going to be looking at what's coming in from an urban renewal district in a particular property year, but you're not going to get what came in because what redevelopment has happened. So you're going to be missing that number. You're also going to be missing all the compression numbers and how that affects everybody's distribution. And so I just caution you that this is an economic development piece that helps with housing, that helps with jobs, what helps with property value, and trying to just look at one number to figure out what's lost, you can't really see the whole picture, and it gets complicated, especially because of Measure 5 and 50. And when you try to tweak the system, you have to remember that each city is different. Their needs are different. And so if you start putting in one size fits all, it affects all of our communities differently. And so we think the changes made in 2009 were the right ones. And the additional restrictions that a community may want should be up to that individual community and those districts working together. A state statute here, we just don't see a path forward. And so at this point, we oppose both the bill and the underlying amendment.
Great. Thank you so much. I sure appreciate that input.
Morning, Chair Langner and the members of the committee. My name is Sean Farrelly, and I'm the Redevelopment Project Manager for the City of Tigard. Also serve as the Vice President of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, speaking in opposition to the bill. The City of Tigard currently has an urban renewal district that's helped revitalize its downtown. Such projects as street and sidewalk improvements, grants to improve small businesses, and public space creation. And this has stimulated millions of dollars in new investment in the area. And another potential district to transform an underutilized area with major infrastructure deficiencies will be decided by Tigard voters in May. And Tigard urban renewal districts have to be approved by the voters. Tigard Mayor John Cook, who's also the chair of our urban renewal board, submitted a letter into the record. I'll just expand on a couple of those points. I have real concerns about the mandate for all the taxing districts that have representative on the urban renewal board. In Tigard's case, we would have to expand our board from 5, the members of the city council, to 14 members. This would make a really unwieldy board. We've got doubts whether we could always get a quorum and make it difficult to make timely decisions. And Tigard's also really concerned about the provision for taxing districts essentially having veto power over forming new districts. I think that the current system for consultation with the overlapping taxing district is working very well. And we can illustrate that with a really recent experience. Over the past few months, Tigard staff developed the plans for the second new district and worked early and very closely with the taxing districts. In response to concerns raised by the fire district representative about the draft plan, we made several adjustments to our plan about the district's time duration and the requirements for concurrence from taxing jurisdictions if there's ever a plan amendment. And they reported being very satisfied with the process. So to sum up, Tigard is very concerned about House Bill 2470 would impede the use of an important local tool for economic and community development. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? All right. I really appreciate your being here. I think I want to close the public hearing on House Bill 2470, and I'm going to note that we are carrying over the last bill on our agenda for today, the framework bill. We're not quite ready to move that because amendments are not yet ready. So with that, we'll thank you for coming and adjourn the meeting.